I would like to first introduce you to J. Paul Haynes, CEO of Eason Tire, for a first conversation. Welcome, Jay. Great to have you here.
Pleased to be here.
So, Jay, there are opportunities of building cloud businesses focused on the mid-market customers, and many entrepreneurs are leveraging those to build compelling businesses today. Tell us about Eason Tire's business. What do you do?
Sure. Eason Tire is in the world of cybersecurity, and we actually have taken it upon ourselves to solve a very difficult problem. That's building the technology and running it for the customers, and it's really quite a stark contrast. We have built a business to target mid-sized organizations, and mid-sized organizations have greater challenges than some of their larger ones from the perspective of the lack of resources and the inability to monitor their networks on a 24/7 basis. So the whole genesis of the business, which began in 2001, was to take on this problem and own it for the customers. So we have always been focused on the mid-market, and we have developed some techniques or tradecraft, as we refer to it in the industry, that are very advanced, very much mirroring what you might find Intel agencies doing. And we've created a version of that which we use in a commercial setting. And over the years, we've been sort of lobbying the analysts, and a couple years ago, they started recognizing that what we were doing was a distinct new way of delivering cybersecurity solutions, and they created a category around what we do, as well as a few competitors as well, called Managed Detection and Response. We are the largest in the world that does this, and we have about 20% market share, and this market is poised to grow 15-fold over the next 5 years. So we're very excited. It was an overnight success that took us from 2001 to this year to get there, but it's been very steady and focused a lot on mid-sized organizations.
So two questions. One is, how do you define mid-sized? What is, mid-sized could be 20 to 50 employee organizations. It could be 500 to 1,000 people organizations. What is your sweet spot, and what is your definition of mid-sized?
Yeah, so that has evolved over time, to be frank, but when we started, it was sort of 25 to 500 was our typical target customer. Now it would be probably more likely, 25 to 25,000. And those are still, in some definitions, on the lower end of enterprise, or, small to medium enterprise, SME is one of the terms. Everyone's got their own definition, but for us, the ideal customer, and it varies by sector, will be, somewhere in the, 50 to 5,000 range. That's where you get the trade-off between recognizing the problem, having a high sensitivity to cyber risk, and also recognizing that you can't do it yourself and you need to bring in an outside party to help. So it's very much a SaaS model business. We deliver security as a service. That includes all the technology, all the provisioning. This is hardware, software, the people to install and configure it, and continuously monitor it and stop threats as they're occurring on a 24/7 basis. So it's quite simply a single line item to take care of all of that complexity. And that's some of the terms that we use. We manage the complexity of running advanced cybersecurity tools on behalf of our customers.
And when you started this in 2001, why did you choose to focus on this particular problem?
Well, it's an interesting question. The problem chose us. Just to set the record straight, I joined the firm in 2009. I had been an advisor to it from early on, like in the mid-2000 timeframe. So the market chose us from the perspective of the business started as a consulting model, which is actually good advice for anybody. Generate cash flow, create a little bit of surplus so you can afford to do some R&D, and that was the business prior to my getting involved. But the market chose us in the sense that the firm was developing the technologies, and then the customer said, well, if you just wrote a cron job or sort of a batch process to do all that sort of monitoring work that you're logging in to do, and then you figure out how to have that notify you, then you could do it on a 24/7 basis. This was back in the day when there wasn't a really clear understanding of what's now referred to as an MSSP, a managed security service provider. That whole market was evolving. There's only a couple of firms in the early 2000s that were really pioneering this method of delivery. And eSentire was largely following what they were doing, but the market was the one that really pulled us in that direction. So the company pivoted from being a consulting firm, focusing on financial services in New York City, to becoming a continuous monitoring firm, and then ultimately delivering security as a service. And then when I joined, we had started making some pretty fundamental IP investments. And those IP investments allow us to bring a very advanced capability, which is now referred to as managed detection and response. That's sort of a branch of security as a service.
And where does the capability of doing all this, like the technical capability, come from? Was that capability in the founding team? You recruited the capability? How did you? Because this stuff is, you know, cybersecurity tends to be fairly technical stuff, and you need particular domain knowledge to build a cybersecurity company. Where did that come from?
It's a great question. It's a combination of, I'll give you today's snapshot and go back in time. So today, depending on which report you read, you will see there's 100 or 1.5 million open cybersecurity positions around the world. So it's a huge problem for the industry. They can't get the qualified skills. It's not something people sign up for and take in university or college at the volumes that the industry is requiring. And the risk is accelerating because the bad guys are using largely being, you know, criminal or opportunistic threat actors. They're using lots of advanced capabilities. They use cloud computing to automate what they're doing. So they're getting very rapid growth, and we aren't able to, you know, get the analysts trained fast enough to meet the industry's needs, which is why the whole security as a service market, particularly advanced threat side where we are, is opening up in such a rapidly growing space. But back when the firm was founded, it was, we're right in the, sort of the 20-mile radius of the University of Waterloo, which is considered to be one of the top three computer science schools, computer engineering schools in the world. You know, Stanford, MIT, and Waterloo, depending which, you know, person you talk to, will, you know, one of, they're all, you know, largely equivalent in terms of their advanced research. And so we have our founders both came from there, and we've benefited from being local and being able to hire PhDs from there and other undergraduates to help us build out our tools. Some of the most advanced crypto in the world has come out of here. There's a company called Certicom, which ultimately got acquired by RIM, which was the firm that pioneered elliptic curve cryptography, which is what is built into the BlackBerry from the very beginning. Well, that that kind of gives you an idea of the ecosystem that we have here. So a lot, very strong in math, but we're surrounded by five other universities and another six colleges. So we're a super dense area of higher education, and we recruit from all of these institutions. And that's today, but the founders and the guys that were solving the problem originally came out of the University of Waterloo.
Okay. Now, talk to us about your go-to-market strategy. One of the, especially in the lower end, but the moment you're in the low end of the large enterprise business, that is direct enterprise selling from a go-to-market strategy point of view. But it sounds like you have had a considerable business in the lower end of the SME or the mid-market, like 50 to 100 customer companies. What is the percentage of business that you do with that segment, and what is your go-to-market strategy for that?
Great question. I've got lots to there's a journey here as well in how to build the business, so I've got lots to share in this respect. So one of the things that I'll get in a soapbox and talk about is, it's better to have, 30 or 40% of a sub-market than to have, 0.2% of an overall market. So when we started the business, we focused on industries that had a high sensitivity to cyber risk, and financial services and Wall Street was who we were dealing with. And that is a very tight market. They're geographically close. They have associations. They reference each other a lot. They don't respond as much to websites and brochures as they do to what is their colleague doing at the firm two buildings over. So it's a very tight referential market. So we went after that market originally. And I can say today that we're securing over $5 trillion worth of assets under management, centered in Wall Street, but globally. This would include London, Hong Kong, Singapore, San Francisco, Toronto, and other parts of the world. So,
one second, Jay. There's some problem with the line. There's a noise coming in. Maureen, where is this noise coming from? Do you have any sense? Is it from Jay's line? All right, go ahead, Jay. Let's try.
Okay. So we started the business selling into mid-sized financial services, and these were all, as you pointed out, in the larger market, it's definitely a field sales or in-person solution sell. But what we also found was that this domain is fairly esoteric, and it does require a high degree of matching of subject matter experts with sales professionals. So what we did was used a field sales model with solution engineers into what most would consider to be an inside sales size market. Our transaction size is probably worth talking about for a moment. So this is a SaaS model where most of the customers are on for many, many years. They don't want to buy this solution as a sort of a B2C kind of SaaS solution. They're really thinking of it as more of a B2B kind of SaaS solution. So they don't want to buy something that they're going to flip out in 6 months or a year. So what we did was focused on getting our average contract value back in that period of time that was about $45,000 a year, and then signing multiple year agreements. Some of them paid monthly, some of them paid quarterly. A few of them at that stage were paying annually. If we fast forward to today, the average contract value has about doubled, and we do three-year agreements with annual prepay in advance. So when you're looking at that sort of order of magnitude, that's the customer's looking at spending $250,000 or more with you. You can easily justify having field sales and solution engineers out in the wild. But when we started the business, it was very market-specific financial services in New York City, but to be more specific, within what's called the Golden Rectangle, which is the area around Midtown, where all the cool guys hang out now. That's really where most of our customers exist in that market. And so you could be very efficient. And I remember in the early days, we'd fly down in the morning, an hour flight from here, and do five or seven sales calls and take the last flight out. And that you can be super. Super efficient in a person-to-person model. And then once you get a referential base, we have now grown to be the number one in that sub-market, and it's largely self-referencing. We probably still to this day have 50% of our business has come to us via referral. But then we've expanded quite aggressively out of that. We'll get to some of the market expansion in some subsequent topics, but we have found other verticals, the legal industry, the high tech industry, any IP based industry. So you have software, silicon based, biopharma, and legal. All are custodian.
Hold on for a second, Jeff. Let me underscore a couple of points that you made here. First and foremost, the average contract size of 45,000 that you started with already pegs you at a certain target segment. So with that, it's possible actually to do some amount, and especially with multi-year deals. So you're talking about $100,000 plus dollar contracts. Your strategy of actually applying a regular field sales model, at least to the first set of customers, to develop a reference base makes a lot of sense. And folks, those of you who are doing, you know, mid-market, but, you know, going a little bit high into mid-market, where you have enough contract size to be able to do direct selling into the accounts and get, you know, some substance, some heft in the deal sizes to be able to justify direct selling. That's one key lesson to take away from this conversation. The other one that you said, Jay, that is worth underscoring is the focus on mid-sized financial services. That's a very tight community. There's a lot of referencing of one another's choices of technologies going on. And this is true in a lot of different verticals where people are getting together and talking about their technology choices, technology problems. And there are specific, domain-specific, vertical-specific issues that if you can work into your solution, then you can talk their language and sell them stuff that they are looking to buy, the problems that they're trying to heal. So these are, you know, points that are worth taking away from this conversation. There's one question that I have, Jay, as a follow-up to what you said. How did you get the first, maybe first one or first five financial services contracts of the nature that we just discussed? What was the penetration strategy into that market?
Initially, it was all referential. The one of the founders who had lived in New York City for many years had a great Rolodex, and he was very well regarded in terms of his information security expertise or cybersecurity expertise. So, so he got called in by one of his colleagues after he moved back to Canada from Manhattan, and that was really the genesis of it, and that became a reference to another organization and another. So it really was referential selling. They had a Rolodex, and it's, you know, I couldn't underscore. Yeah, exactly. You really got to have. It's harder when you don't have a friendly that you can knock on a door. And I mean, we use today one of our main selling strategies to use proof of concepts where we actually install full working systems at no expense to the customer and show them what we can see from our threat analysis perspective. And getting friendlies in the initial days to agree to that, where, you know, nobody wants to be everyone wants to be first to be second, right? Nobody wants to be first. So it's a huge advantage if you can have some friendlies to help, you know, do those trials and prove yourself out. Because we all can build the technology, and we just got to get in front of the people that need the problem solved to be able to demonstrate where it can add value, or send it back to the drawing board if we need to alter it to meet customer needs. But you need those friendlies, especially at the nascent stage of tech firms.
Yeah. Now, what has been your financing strategy? You've done this out of Canada, out of Waterloo, near about Waterloo?
Yeah. So the financing strategy, so the company bootstrapped. It was all eat what you kill initially for the first eight or 9 years. There was no major outside capital, a few minor debt instruments, but it was always a cash flow business. But what you'll find is, you know, your cash flow businesses don't have enough capital to sort of pivot and become a technology product marketing, or in our case, service marketing firm. So you need to bring
I'm going to stop you on that point and disagree completely, because we have case study after case study of people having bootstrap companies using services and very hefty technology companies. Oracle was founded in that mode. So that statement is false, but go ahead and talk about your journey without making general statements.
To mount a product marketing firm doing solution selling, we needed outside capital. And that outside capital was initially secured through, you know, what you'd call a Series A venture institutional investor. That first
in
one
Canada?
Came out of Canada, yeah. And that was a couple $1 million round. And then our next one came from a New York-based fund, which was a $7 million round. And then as we continued to grow, most of this capital has been deployed into a go-to-market expansion, sales and marketing expense, to drive the kind of growth that that we were, notwithstanding the academic studies, to drive the kind of growth we needed, and everything that all of the growth equity venture and then growth equity partners were telling us is we were not spending enough on sales and marketing expansion because we had such high customer retention rates. So we continued to pour more capital into the business, and then did two subsequent 14 million rounds. So so to date, we've got 34 million of equity into the business through a combination of, venture sort of seed stage through through growth equity, which are tend to be investors that come in at later stages.
And what are the metrics, current metrics of the business? And in particular, talk about the distribution within the SME customer base. So how has the business, evolved? What percentage of the business is the smaller of the SMEs? What percentage is the smaller of the enterprise? Well, how does the business map out today?
The business, we have, handful, like a few dozen customers that you would consider, most people would consider to be enterprise. That would be more than, 10,000 employee kind of organization. So the vast majority of our 550 customers are in that that mid-size definition that we had talked about earlier. We've got a channel strategy where we have MSPs, managed service providers, and private cloud, virtual private cloud service providers using our solution as a multi-tenancy fashion. We have other channels, partners that are what you would call value-added resellers, where they actually take our solution in conjunction with some of their other capabilities to a customer. And then we have other channel partners that are referral, and they bring deals to us and hand them over to us for a finder's fee. But in the last two cases, we still maintain a large involvement in the sales process. But back to your metrics question, the things that we track the business around are gross margin. We track rate of growth. We track customer acquisition costs. And, and we've used this since 2012 when we sort of discovered some of the Bessemer metrics, which are quite well read in the industry. They had the 10 principles of a SaaS business, which were really built around a B2C model. And we adapted that to the B2B model. So customer acquisition cost and long-term value and absolute rate of growth and customer retention. So those are the key metrics. And none of those are GAAP measures, which is interesting. And those are the, if you were to talk to any investors in SaaS businesses, that some combination of those, maybe plus or minus a few, that they use to establish enterprise value. So it's very important. Nowadays, very clear and understood, maybe not so much, 5 or 8 years ago, what are the key measures of health in the business. So our customer retention rate is very high 90s, 98 to 99 range. And so when you measure long-term value of customers, what you do is, you look at how many years you're going to get, you're going to get your customer acquisition costs back, and they have this LTV to customer acquisition cost ratio, and those are very important metrics. We have varied from the Bessemer model to use gross margin versus top line, which is how they originally started out. And so those are the things that we track these on a month by month and quarter by quarter basis, and do all kinds of things to improve operational side of the business. We measure how fast we can onboard customers, and I've created a KPI internally, which is not in the Bessemer chart, which I call the ink to income, and that's how fast can we book a customer onto our contract and then start delivering the service so that we can recognize the revenue. And for us, that's a cash flow and an operational efficiency measure.
Can you double click down on your customer acquisition cost measurement? Because you are doing B2B, as you said, and you also pointed out through the conversation that the bulk of your customer acquisition is through referrals. So how do you quantify your customer acquisition costs given those parameters?
I'll give you some very high level numbers without really you getting into specifics, but what we do is we have that sound again here.
1 second. Maureen, what's going on? All right, go ahead.
So the way that you measure customer acquisition costs is you take all of your sales and marketing costs from the quarter previously, at least this is the way that we do it, and this is very close to the Bessemer definition. Take all the sales and marketing costs, and then you divide by the number of new logos acquired in the next quarter. So when we do that calculation, we will end up with numbers that range between $50,000 and $75,000. And if you look at what we get in terms of our average contract value, which we talked about previously, and our gross margin, we can see that from a gross margin perspective, that customer is paid back in somewhere in the 12 to 18 month range, depending whether they've gone to a channel or come directly to us. So at the end of, let's say, the average of that being 15 months, at the end of 15 months, everything for that customer going forward is in the black, so to speak. So it takes us that long to recover the cost of acquiring the customers. Now, when you look at the referral nature of it, that's just getting into the account to actually, win the account, which, means, flying in solution engineers and sales guys and commissions and all that that goes into it. That's the pot of expense that we're mixing up and dividing by the number of new logos. So we look at it as what we acquired this quarter was from efforts in the previous quarter. It's not a perfect science, but it is from a quarter over quarter trend is a very a good number to track, at least from our business perspective.
So folks, audience, make note of one thing here that is going to be pertinent to your journeys, those of you who are building B2B SaaS businesses. These days, SaaS metrics are very well understood by investors. And even in very early stage financing, seed stage financing, Series A financing, people are tracking metrics like hawks. So even to raise a seed or a Series A financing, you're going to need to have as much understanding of your customer acquisition cost, long-term customer value, et cetera, as possible. And the better understanding you have of that, the higher your chances of getting funded. And that's kind of, you will say it's very unfair because, we're just starting out, we don't understand, we can't possibly understand because we are blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't matter. The issue is that the industry is moving upstream. On every quarter by quarter basis, the industry is moving further upstream. The funding industry is moving further upstream. So getting early stage companies funded without concrete metrics these days is getting very, 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 very difficult. So you're going to somehow or the other get to concrete metrics as quickly as possible. Jay, what are you seeing in Canada?
You mean from an investment perspective?
Well, in general, from the startup community that you are part of course, you're much further along now, much bigger and so forth, but I imagine that you have some window into the Canadian startup world.
Yeah, so in where I am, we have, it's called the Toronto-Waterloo Tech Corridor. It's second only to Silicon Valley. It's very large. About 200,000 tech workers. I think the Valley has 350,000. So, of the same order of magnitude, in a relatively shorter travel distance, if you know the differences between the two. In the Waterloo end, which I'm closer to, there are approximately 750 startups right now, of varying, lineages. Some have, vertical focus. Some have, B2B, some are in robotics, some are in biometric measurement capabilities. It's a full cross-section. There's a Y Combinator sort of early stage funding organization here. There's a tech association that provides a lot of mentoring services for startups. So separate from the startups, there's another group called scale-ups. We're in that scale-up category, so those are like the, you know, the 20 to 50 million or 20 to 100 million companies, and there's about, I think there's about 80 of those in the, you know, sort of a 30 or 40 mile radius of here. So there's lots of startups, and some of the startups go to the Valley, some have come from the Valley. One of the things that we've got here besides the University of Waterloo is we've got some of the top machine learning and artificial intelligence researchers in the world, some from Google that are associated with the University of Toronto. There's a huge push in the Toronto end of this corridor around machine learning and artificial intelligence. You'll see lots, I'm sure, in the coming years coming out of that. So these are interesting organizations because it's all data science applied to, you know, a lot of SaaS or large analytical opportunities. So we're seeing a couple of these pockets emerging. Other areas in Canada, Montreal has a pretty strong, it used to be known for gaming. They've got a strong AI machine learning group as well. Vancouver has its own little enclave of, its own enclave of tech firms that run a wide cross-section. They've got quantum computing there. We've got quantum computing research here. Canada's a very spread out country with these folk, you know, these clusters around the major metropolitan areas. But it's really, it's such a vast country. It's very much a north-south, so in Canada, you know, you get an idea, you can test it locally, but your market is head straight south, and that's been my, you know, past six companies have been largely on that model.